Lovely to be here. Thanks very much for venturing out on publishing evening. My name is John Clark. I'm a journalist with a special interest, I guess, in social science. I've also edited this book on the poverty crisis. It's pretty hard to miss on the streets of Bristol and on the streets of everywhere else, to be honest. So I'm delighted to be chairing this discussion with Samira Shackle, who is one of our best long-form journalists. She's done deep reportage on things like the poverty crisis, but also completely different things like what really went on with that drone that you might remember at Gatwick Airport. So if you want something solving and to get to the bottom of things, you can send Samira to it. And Danny Dowling, who is Professor of Geography at Oxford and also one of the country's most prestigious, prolific researchers and writers. We're talking about one new book today, but he's already told me he's got another one on the way, and this is a bit of a habit. I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about. I thought what we'd do, for the sake of keeping conventional, is to follow a 3R model, where we spend roughly 20 minutes talking about, 15 minutes talking about the realities, what's going on now. Can we tell you about what's going on from Samira's perspective of like going and talking to people and Danny's looking at the numbers. Then the roots of these problems, if they are indeed worse than we think in the UK, like what's happened to us over what sort of time period, why are things worse here perhaps than in other countries, how long did this take to set in? And then because we promised, despite having one book about broken Britain and one book called Broke Here to talk about, we're going to talk about fixing as well. So the third R will be remedies, where we put our heads together and try and think about what kind of tweaks, changes, big or small, we can think of that might fix some of this. And we promised to leave a good 20 minutes or so at the end to make sure that you can get in for questions as well. So if that sounds all right, without further ado, I'll hand over to Samira, who's going to read a bit of her inquiry into hunger, which I think is one aspect of poverty that nobody would deny is real poverty. We always get these arguments about, where does poverty start? Is it real poverty if it's in Britain? But when people are hungry, it's pretty rare to say that isn't. So, Samira, over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Neil Jones. Thanks again, everyone, for being here in this room. The section I'm going to read to you is about a woman whose name I call Yvonne in the chapter that I contributed to Broke. She's a woman in her 60s. She worked as a social worker for most of her life. She came to the UK. She felt the Windrush generation when she was about 10. Was a social worker, raised four kids on her own, and always did, sort of got by until she developed a degenerative spine condition and found herself unable to work and reliant on benefits, and then things sort of steadily got much, much worse. And I spoke to her at a point where she was really, really struggling a lot. She hadn't told any of her adult children how much she was struggling because she didn't want them to put themselves into financial difficulty. I think the way that she spoke about what she was going through really illustrated to me just sort of quite how severe the situation is for so many people. So I'll just read this bit to you. Yvonne continued to go to the food hub fortnightly. Standing in the queue and waiting was too difficult to manage every single week. Even worse was her increasing anxiety about cooking. Each time she switched on the cooker, that was money on her gas and electric bill. Even in June 2022, once energy costs and other unavoidable bills had been deducted from her universal credit payment, she was left with just £5 for the month. She sat down on her own in her darkened living room and wept. "I'm just thinking, what do I do now? How do I cope?" she said. At the hub, she began to take only foods that she could eat without cooking. In a good week, she might get some fresh fruit, bananas, apples, or salad and tinned sardines or mackerel, but it was unpredictable. Sometimes the only options were cornflakes, tinned fruit, or baked beans. Whenever there were cereal bars available, she tried to stock up because they were not only filling, but required no cooking or warming at all. Somehow, I've got to pay my bills and I've got to survive, she told me. This was the middle of summer when the evenings were light and the days were hot. The thought of the winter looming ahead filled her with dread. Yvonne is not alone in this. At the Tottenham Food Bank, staff told me that even in summer, they'd noticed that people attending the hub were making different choices based on their energy bills. People were refusing to take potatoes because 15 minutes on the hob or 30 minutes in the oven was too expensive. People are looking more for things that can be cooked quickly and easily, so they're using less gas and electricity, Kirsty Johnson, the warehouse manager, told me. They're taking quick things like noodles or microwave rice that take a minute in the microwave, as opposed to a bag of rice that takes 10 minutes on the hob. Ready meals, always a popular option for food bank users in temporary accommodation without proper cooking facilities, are increasingly popular across the board. Rebecca McManaman, who's a dietitian, points out that a reliance on these kinds of convenience foods is one contributing factor to malnutrition, something the BDA now estimates 3 million adults in the UK are at risk of. If someone already has a low body weight, it can take just 5 days to start experiencing symptoms of malnutrition. People feel low, people can feel fatigued, feel like things are an effort, and that can then be a vicious cycle within itself, said McManaman. The effects don't stop with mental health. GP Yasota Brown explains, the most obvious impact of malnutrition is that your immunity is weakened, so you're more prone to infections, not bouncing back or recovering as quickly. It's a big stress on your system. For Yvonne, food had once been a source not of anxiety but of pleasure, not just eating it but preparing it, planning it. She lived in a ground floor flat with a garden and she had an old barbecue that she used to use in the summers. She wondered if she could get hold of a bag of coal so that she could cook outside without using gas or electricity. She inquired at the food hub if that was something they could help her with, but staff was stumped. But more often these days, she didn't want to bother. One evening, the thought of opening a tin was too depressing. She had a banana and went to bed, telling herself, if you're sleeping, you won't feel hungry. Each day, Yvonne woke up and told herself that she had to focus on today because no one is guaranteed that tomorrow. She repeated affirmations to herself. I tell myself, you will survive, you're strong, you're a survivor, you're beautiful. Sometimes it helped, sometimes she laughed at herself. It was a relief to feel some lightness, so she carried on murmuring these affirmations to herself along with her daily prayers. Carrying on was the only thing that was left to do.
I mean, it's bleak, isn't it? I mean, and there's so much in that chapter about going on, about shame, the hesitation that Yvonne feels, the way, you know, she's got this terrible pain when it comes to walking and sort of has to hobble her way to the food bank. What that section, I think, really brings out is the way, you know, we try to theme this book, organise it around people being cold, people being hungry, people lacking, say, roof over their heads. People also being, you know, in ill health. But what you found is that you can't sustain these barriers. The chapter on ill health ended up being about how ill health makes you poor. The chapter on the worst pockets of poverty in Glasgow is about how being poor made you sick. You know, so that, the whole thing feeds round and round. And in Yvonne's case, what really I remember about her story is I think that she did have children, she had adult children, and she couldn't tell them. So, you know, here we are talking about very material, the most basic material form of poverty, but it then turns into social isolation as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and she also stopped socialising as much because she didn't want to have to explain to her friends how badly she was doing, and that was quite a common theme with the different people I spoke to for this book, who were even if they might have had friends or loved ones who could have helped, they were too ashamed to ask or didn't want to admit quite how tough things were. Often a lot of resistance to going to food banks or food hubs, this kind of huge network of emergency food provision that sprung up. I mean, a lot of, it's really a last resort for a lot of people just because of the shame involved in going to talk.
And of course, everything that's mushroomed since, you know, in the 21st century, we didn't have this. We didn't have food banks in any number until really quite recently. I think in Danny's books, there's some numbers on that.
If you've got them.
The numbers are easier. This is the problem about talking about this. I found if I'm doing a talk for 45 minutes on my own about this, I can't do a talk for 45 minutes. Even though I do numbers, I don't tell you stories of real people. It's actually too depressing to do it. So luckily, we're sharing this today. And it will get more hopeful, don't worry. We're starting with the reality. You get these people who don't believe this. And the people who don't believe won't be here tonight. You don't come to a talk like this if you don't believe there's a problem, unless you're particularly strange, maybe one of you. We'll be kind. So it's the numbers that you have to use for the people who don't believe it. And let's start with, can you get rid of this? Are the poor and the feckless, as they call them, always with us? Rowntree Foundation. The Rowntree Foundation was created by Joseph Rowntree around about 1900 because he saw what his father did about 50 years earlier when his father helped create the first soup kitchen in York. And his father was a nice Quaker. He was Willy Wonka. He had the chocolate factory, but he didn't like seeing people going hungry. And so he began the soup kitchen, and the soup kitchens grew, and you had more food being given out to free, to the destitute, the undeserving poor, in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. Little Joseph is growing up, becomes Big Joseph, and by the time he's approaching his own death, realises that what his father has done has not helped at all. The hunger's still there. And so it creates a Rowntree Foundation whose explicit aim is to end poverty and fund almost anything that might be required to do that other than soup kitchens. That's the famous line in the charter of the Rowntree Foundation. His son, Seaborn Rowntree, does the research and the Oxford Rowntree Foundation, does the Survey of York, finding absolute destitution in 1901. There's another survey in 1936 that actually finds it's got worse, which you might find hard to believe, but the poverty hasn't improved because we have mass unemployment by 1936. But things changed. And by the time that Seaborn Rowntree, Joseph's son, did his survey in 1952, no soup kitchens. Hunger had almost disappeared. It just fell and fell. We had full employment. And not just full employment, it was well-paid employment. It paid for enough food. So we didn't need food banks in the 1970s. Only a few began in the 1980s. It is entirely possible to get rid of this. For people who say, oh, it's just the feckless, and it's always most heart-wrenching to do children, but what you've got to think, I'm going to give you children, but then you've got to think, well, how much worse is it for those groups we don't care about, because we do care about children. The height of our children stopped rising around about 2010 for children at the age of five. The exact dates matter because they're born in 2005. Their height isn't rising in 2010. You can't entirely blame the coalition. Right? Any of you who think that Tony Blair was an absolutely wonderful thing, I'm afraid the numbers don't show it. The height of our children stopped rising in 2010. The height of children in the rest of Europe is still rising. The height of our children now has begun to go down. This is on average in all of them. This is stunning to achieve that. The extreme statistics and stories are of those who believe, but this is the average. Or the Resolution Foundation, middle of the road, Blairite, think tank, nice people, not radicals, produced their State of the Nation report at the beginning of this year. 56% of children with two or more siblings, which almost always means two, so think of a child with a brother and sister, 56% of them in the UK are going hungry two or three times a month. And that's really hungry, that's not peckish, they are missing their meals on a day two or three times a month. 56%. a majority of children in the UK who had the misfortune to be in a family of three. Why is it a family of three? Because you don't get child benefit on the third family, because George Osborne thought that would be a jolly good thing. Oh, but of course he was just an extreme conservative, wasn't he, George Osborne? Labour would never adopt a two-child policy, would they? They do. Our two main parties are remarkably similar, which is partly why you can get into this situation of having a return of hunger at this level. In a country absolutely full of food, the amount of food that's going to be thrown away from these restaurants tonight will be staggering. And it is just shocking. But the point of doing the numbers, they are a bit inhuman. Like 56% has an effect on you, but if I was to tell you a story of a particular family, I could get some of you crying. But it's for those people who think, oh, this is just an extreme thing. And occasionally at meetings somebody comes out and says, oh, not that again. The thing I've told myself I don't believe. They're just not trying hard enough. And we still have that attitude really strongly. They're not trying hard enough. We have to make them try. If as a sort of downer, let me leave you with sort of the worst side of this. There's a famous phrase, she may have come from Bristol. Hunger is more effective than the overseer's whip. If you want to get people to work, far better than them being slaves and you whipping them is that they're hungry. Now, what's more effective than hunger is the idea that your children will go hungry. That's really effective to get you out doing that third job, not trying to live off benefits and so on. And we've got to face it. There are people who believe that hunger should be used to make other people work. Not everywhere in the UK, so let's just give you one bit of optimism and then I'll hand back. When the cost of living crisis began, the Scottish Government convened their equivalent of COBRA. They met every week, the same committee that was meeting through the pandemic. They did various things, including ensuring that people couldn't be evicted from their homes, that landlords were being controlled. But in particular, they decided to concentrate on children. They introduced what they called the Scottish Child Payment on top of child benefit. And in Scotland, you get child benefit on the third child, and very rarely, because there are no families of four on the fourth child. In Scotland, they call what we do the rape clause. Just in case you didn't know, you do have three children. If your third child was a result of rape, you can tell the EP about the rape, and you might even get child benefit. In Scotland, they call it the rape clause. They introduced £10 a week for children under six of any family. He was claiming any form of benefit, then they increased that about a year and a half ago, and then in November of last year, they increased the Scottish Child Payment to £25 a week for every child under 16 in Scotland whose family claimed any form of benefit, which is 2 out of 7 children, almost all the children who are poor, very poor in Scotland, and it isn't tapered. You get that money. Your other benefits are not reduced. You get it. That, for a family of three in Scotland, is £3,900 a year. That means that no child this winter goes hungry or cold in Scotland at all. Do we report it? No, we don't. Do we like it? We hate it. The WP hate it, Westminster hate it. Because you can't have people not living in fear that their children are going to go cold and hungry if they don't behave. That's where we're back to. Those are the attitudes. Not just our politicians in Westminster, it's the press not reporting this, and it's the attitudes. But the great news is, when I describe what's going on, I normally, to students, describe the policy but not the place, then I ask them to guess which country it is. And it's normally Sweden or Norway that they first guess, and then eventually they get round to the Netherlands or Germany. On an average, it takes university students from our top school, the universities, 10 countries before they work out, oh, it's Scotland. And then I go, well, of course it can't happen here because Scotland's such a very different place to us that we couldn't possibly do that policy. And £25 a week is so much money, how could we afford it? I try not to be cynical about this, but the solution, at least for children, is rather obvious. You can't actually eat that much as a child. The amount of food required to stop a child going hungry is not very much. Well, if we don't have a growing number of children in Scotland either, you're not looking at an exponentially growing future food bill. It's not going to cause a population explosion. The solution, so here, the question is, how have we got ourselves into such a nasty state that we, almost uniquely in Europe, are willing to tolerate this?
So, I mean, I wonder whether one reason, I mean, we can go on about the numbers, and as you say, they're pretty bad. I mean, one you haven't mentioned, I know you mentioned in the book, is about life expectancy. And the interesting thing here is, you know, like we used to say, life expectancy always goes up, except in times of war. In the United States, much of the 21st century has been kind of bobbing about or going down a bit. For very social reasons, the opioid crisis and suicides and things like that, that you know have clearly got quite social roots. There's a Nobel Prize winning economist, he's kind of documented all this, and speaks and Alan Case. And there's no disputing it. And we're starting to see some of that in the UK, in that life expectancy is very much plateauing actually. And in poor areas going down, before the pandemic, for women in poor areas dying earlier, every day, if you look around for it, you find a miracle cure for this or that in the press, but whatever's going on is overpowering that at a statistical level. So in poor areas, women dying earlier, and then with the pandemic, men in poor areas also dying earlier. And it was an important enough effect that the average stagnated, which it didn't used to. And yet, I might be losing some of you because, as that dreadful man Joseph Stalin said, you know, the death of one man is a tragedy, but the death of a million is a statistic, which is why it is so important to get this testimony, to get this first-hand account of what it feels like, to get people to reflect on the things that they can see in their streets if they've got their eyes open. What I'm seeing, I've already seen here in Bristol, or sort of Liverpool a week or two ago, with these street tents that we didn't used to see. I'm sure you've all seen that as well. But the thing that really changed it, I think, is the empathy that you get by listening to individual people's stories. Now, I'm going to come back to Samir in a second, but I'll just say, it's quite hard to get this testimony. I mean, I remember 10 years ago, the Great Recession, and there was some outrage going on about, you know, people having their benefits arbitrarily cut off, and I was stood there with a little dictaphone outside the job centre, trying to get people to comment on it, and they flinched, Samir. They ran away because, they're being pried, they're being interrogated, they don't feel like anyone's on their side, you know, they've got to get their head down and, like, answer all these tick-tock questions in the right way, otherwise their money might be snatched away. And then when they've been through that bureaucracy, they've got me on the way out going, oh, how do you feel about this? You know, and it's like, no, that's fair enough, that's a human reaction. But you've got in here not just Yvonne's testimony, which you talked about, also Lowry in Blackpool and Sophie in Manchester, all of them. We learn all about them as people and how they used to love food and then food becomes terrible. How do you win that kind of trust?
I think, first of all, being introduced in a few cases by people they trusted. So, just taking up the time over it. So, one whose story I just read was introduced to me by sort of someone who runs a local food quality service and knew her quite well. And then I think just giving, I think it's actually in a way harder to get someone to open up to when they kind of come to it. So just describing when you're standing outside and asking them, but sort of giving someone a bit of a sense of control over how long you speak for and how much time you're giving them and letting them know that they can stop the conversation if they're not comfortable talking a few times, all of those sorts of things. But it's difficult. And I think before I found the people who I ended up writing about in the book, I spent quite a lot of time at the local food bank and food hub, and it became obvious that just wasn't going to work like that. Talking to people, and you know, people would kind of talk for a few minutes, but no one really wants to talk in detail about what that experience is like, because it's humiliating and it's unpleasant and it's something that you're probably trying to think about very much. And actually, some of the things that I just read to you, Yvonne said after that conversation, I actually hadn't set those things aloud because she wasn't talking to her, wasn't talking to her loved ones about it.
No.
And so I think that's, can be helpful to people, but it can also be really painful, and just being sort of cognizant of that as a journalist as well. Because I think it's important to get those testimonies and try and build that empathy and awareness about what people are going through. But if you're an individual and you're just making the choice to share that, you're not going to see a tangible benefit. You don't kind of share your story and your problems are solved at all. So I think it's also just being clear about that. But I think you're right that it's personal stories that illustrate the depth of this. And I think it's also just sometimes certain facts about how things are and how the decisions are being made. So that, for instance, in the section I just read, at that point, it was sort of hearing that from the food bank manager, in fact, that like people won't take potatoes anymore, really, that made me realise in a different way how severe the energy crisis last summer was, and that was a decision people were making. Because I would have thought, you know, having the luxury to not worry that much about when I switch on my hob, I would have thought, logically, you take potatoes or you take a big bag of rice that's going to do loads of meals rather than a small microwave bag of rice that's only going to have two servings in it. That, to me, would be a no-brainer. And actually thinking the whole kind of decision points and the basis on which people are making those decisions in the most rational way for their own budgets and day-to-day is completely different. And that was a real moment for me. Another one was an academic described just the idea of assets in food poverty, and that an asset is, you might describe someone as having assets if they have a freezer full of food that they can fall back on before they go to a food bank, or if they have a relative who can do a weekly shop for them, or just an emergency shop or a hot meal even. And that someone like Yvonne is in the worst case because she doesn't have any of those assets, and she doesn't have anything in her freezer anymore. She's not able to afford enough electricity to keep her freezer switched on. She doesn't got anyone who she can call on to say, you know, I'm really short, can you help me out with stocking up the comps and some basics? And that, again, really made it hit for me. You know, I read all the coverage about the explosion of food banks before I started working on this, and the statistics and so on, but actually it's just those small things, like, oh, I wouldn't think of it as any kind of asset, but I've got a cupboard full of dried pasta and tins and a freezer with meals in it. You know, that doesn't strike me as an asset, but it is.
It's a good point, isn't it? But it's also just in these details, you know, you can do the numbers, you can do the counting, but you get insight as well as emotion out of these details. You know, in something I did 10 years ago, we did these interviews with people, and one of the people who was down on the luck was this guy. He was 47 years old. He was he had been a chef, right? And he was asking, you know, you've got £10 disposable income available. How can you get by on that? And he said, well, should be easy. Couple of eggs, bit of rice, and a couple of potatoes. And he said, and a few pulses. And then it was like, problem is I don't have a cooker right now. Okay. Now, if you've just written that in an academic report and like the quotes without that detail about how he used to be a chef, you just said male 47, it wouldn't come through vividly without the detail you provided with on people taking these packeted meals. That shows you, we talk about these kind of vicious cycles where the bad mental health feels into feeds into bad behaviour, and then from bad behaviour into deeper poverty, and so it goes round. But like, sometimes you need to really talk to people to reflect on these conversations to get the insight about how that actually works, I think. Danny, we need to start segging our way into the kind of roots of it. And I think a step on that road could be talking about Oxford, which is a town you've seen from lots of different angles, as it was, as it is, and then what happened in between to mean it's been on the journey it has.
Yeah, because you could go on and on with the stories about how bad things are now. But the real question is why us? Why the Stephanie Flanders on Bloomberg TV announced in February this year that the poorest fifth of people in the UK are poorer than the average of the poorest fifth in Eastern Europe, most of Eastern Europe. You know, this is a spectacular fall down the rankings. It's for rich countries worldwide. It's actually the USA, like you say, is doing badly. But the USA can print money. The things the USA can do. And people have lots of consumer goods in the USA. Business also have lots of opiates, partly because the family got rich selling them, which now was agreed to have its name taken off all the museums it sponsors. Yeah, so there's progress. I grew up in Oxford in the 1970s. The book Shattered Nation I wrote begins with a story of Oxford. It begins with my childhood recollections, but they weren't entirely those tinted glasses. It was full employment. Well paid full employment. 40,000 car workers and other men, largely, working in jobs supporting a car industry. You could get a house at 25, the majority could get a mortgage. These are the same houses, these are three-bed 1930s houses. There's an associate professor at my university with a bit of family money and some other inheritance might just be able to buy, except of course now they're 50 years older. Car workers had them. We had one of the best schooling systems on the planet. We just got rid of a really nasty system of segregation. The Finns came to actually see what we were doing in Oxford when we introduced comprehensive education, and then they copied it, which is why they're doing so well in Finland. The health service was unbelievable. We had the first to pay the incubators at John Ratcliffe. When I was born, 11 babies died per thousand, lowest of the human race had ever known at the time. This was an incredible time. It's not just Oxford. Sheffield had lower mortality than England as a whole, higher life expectancy for Sheffield. So when you see Brastoff, you see the full Monty, the reason about the shock of the 80s in Sheffield, which you're talking about somewhere that was better on average. I can't tell you the full story because I left Oxford at 18 and then I came back 10 years ago. But angry and divided is it now? I mean, the bitterness and the... only some of us can afford to get a house. Most of my school friends have had to leave. It's like a kind of social cleansing that's occurred. In the year 2000, we worked out the most common way to die at the age of 65 in Oxford was to be homeless. We worked out again in about 2018-19, just using the official statistics. But things did begin to change. The council in Oxford was taking out antisocial behaviour orders on the homeless to try to stop them begging, because it had an assumption that these were people coming in from London, realising that naive students might just give them some cash. But because of the numbers that died, the second highest rate of deaths, we had enough people who died to actually work out that apart from the Polish man on High Bridge Street, they were all local. They've grown up in Oxford, gone away, but when things go really, really bad, you come back to where you were as a child. So when Otis was released from local prison, the nice charity gave him a tent. That's one reason why you see people in tents on the street, because the charity gives you a tent when you're released from prison. Now, Oxford Labour Council changed its policy on ASBOs when it began to realise who it was who were dying. When the stories came out, the Guardian did a very good story about one young woman. And they changed it. They changed the policy and stopped being unbelievably nasty, if you like, to the people whose lives had got the worst. Why did it happen? Partly because things were so good in the 50s and 60s and 70s, because we were still a rich country. We'd only just stopped 30 or 40 years earlier being the richest place on earth, the centre of the largest empire the world has ever known. All well said, we would never have managed to start a welfare state like we did without having had the empire still. We had an empire because we made money out of it. Like, Colston wasn't doing it because he was a nice man, which is why they threw him in the harbour just down there. The Whigwits already know. In Oxford, our statue is a little bit higher. We don't have as many nice anarchists. There is a cherry picker, quite a new college, so if you'd be interested to know, the colleges share the cherry picker, anyway, that's where it is. If you want to be moved down. But, empire, money. So even as we come down and we owe America a huge fortune after the Second World War, we are still relatively rich. We can afford to start a health service. With the help of a nice Conservative minister, the posh men get together, a misogynistic eugenicist called William Beveridge writes a report. He's a liberal, not a particularly nice man. But collectively we get together and decide that we are going to end the very worst of this, once one of idleness, ignorance and disease, and we do. But we forgot. I think, I would actually blame our left. I think we had the weakest left politics on the continent. And it, you know, we always blame Margaret Thatcher and the right. But I'm not quite sure that's right. I think if you look at the left, how did it allow this to happen? But we also on the right, if you look at who was sponsoring Thatcher, who was behind Keith Joseph, who it was, we had this belief that we should be number one. Because a lot of their grandparents had been number one. They were masters of the universe. They were viceroys of India. Our rightful place is at the top again. Not becoming a normal European country, which is what we were heading. Actually, we were the second most equal large country to Sweden when I was a child. I grew up in a Nordic country called England. And some people hated that, because that's where we shouldn't be, and worked very hard to create, if you like, Empire 2.0, the New Jerusalem, our rightful place in the world, trickle down is going to work, liberalise the banks, Big Bang, don't interfere with all of that. The rich are fine and they can get as rich as they want as long as they pay their taxes. All of that, and all the time, we're going up the ranks of inequality, you go from being almost Swedish. So by 2009, we're the most unequal country in Western Europe, we pick Portugal, and then I think it's 2013 that we're playing a game with Bulgaria. It's only Bulgaria that's possibly more unequal. And inequality really matters, because it's inequality that allows you not to see the lives of other people and think, oh, can't they just behave a bit better or work harder? You know, you have to be this unequal to make this number of mistakes and to keep doing it, I think. And I'll be mean, having done nice with the Roundtree Foundation. The Roundtree Foundation were my first employer in the 90s. Nestle had just bought the factory, which means that Roundtree had a lot of shares. Nestle made money out of baby milk. It's all related to food and hunger in a way. And Roundtree had moved away from wanting to eradicate poverty. The Roundtree Foundation was supposed to stop themselves existing within 100 years, to argue that what mattered was poverty and not inequality. Very similar to Peter Magnus. It doesn't matter how much money people make as long as they pay their taxes. And part of the shattering of Britain is having your leading poverty charity saying that inequality isn't the main issue. Right? You know, it's a very basic one. You've got to get out of that hole before you can get any further. There is no unequal country in the rich world that does a good job of things. It just isn't possible to have, as we have, 10% of people taking 40% of all income. Probably the majority of us in this room are in that 10%. The salary is quite low to get into that 10%. We live on 40% of the income of the country every year. And we don't think we're well off because most of us don't have a second home. We don't fly numerous times if we're in the top 10%. Half of us did not send our children to private schools in that top 10%. But we are taking 40% of everything at a time when everything is shrinking because of inflation and cost of living. And the last thing that we can imagine is we might drop to 30%. That would solve it for everybody else. That's an enormous sum of money. that, you know, you get rid of all the hunger and the cold, but all we've got to do is go down from 40% to 30%. Right? And you're sort of thinking, well, is that easy? Why don't we do it? Because we've become like Germany overnight. Our best schools in the world would all have to close because the people don't afford to pay the fees, apart from the people flying in who are increasingly using them. The London housing market would collapse if we, the top 10%, went from having 40% of everything to 30%. Life as you know it would end. I can be cynical and say, you know, no more holidays in Tuscany. But it really, you'd have to mix. Your children would have to mix with other people's children. And that is terrifying.
I mean, that's all very interesting, but I still don't understand why Britain, with its history, with its imperial worldview, with its class system, got together in the 1940s and instituted labour reforms, and you've shown recently, even before the Second World War, inequality was already being compressed.
Yeah.
Things were moving in the right direction on the inequality front for a long time. And then it switched, you know, it didn't switch in, you said we were like Sweden, it didn't switch in Sweden. What is it about Britain this time, in this place, in this time?
Well, yeah.
That we haven't, and while you're at it, like, why is it that that gives you hope that things might change again?
Okay, I'm hopeful, by the way, yeah. All European countries, inequality began to fall dramatically after 1918. So we weren't that special. The First World War was not supposed to, it was supposed to go on a few weeks. It goes on for years, it costs a fortune, you have to borrow the money, people borrow the money from want it back, then people have the money in the rich, you take their houses off them, they donate it to the National Trust. It's a very short version. The most common job for women was to be a servant, think of wives they'd be visited. They'd almost all gone by the 1950s, all the servants. It was a rapid, but it wasn't just us. This was absolutely necessary. I mean, there were other things that the Russian Revolution scared the rich. They realised the repercussions of trying to keep like it was, as you might just be put against the wall and shot. That helped. The trade unions helped. Suffragettes helped. But I think those posh boys helped as much as anything else. You know, Keynes, the Bloomsbury set. Tawney, spending a day in the Somme in the shell hole. William's best friend, William Beveridge, married his sister, which was useful, historically. I would hope it would be somebody other than William, had he not married Tawney's sister, but marrying Jean, by the way, is the key to all of this. He never gets with love, it's the wife of Beveridge, like Shakespeare's sister, the one who actually really did it. Sorry, speed up. So this happened across Europe, and we didn't stop it happening here. The middle class couldn't afford the doctor by the late 30s, which is one reason why we had to nationalise all the charity and private hospitals. The middle class couldn't afford necessarily to send their children private, which is why you have to get rid of the 11 plus. The 11 plus is absolutely fine when you can afford to send the boy private if he fails it. But if you can't afford to send the boy is the only one that matters, remember, in the very recent past, if you can't send the boy private, you need comprehensive education. We did a huge amount of this for us, for the top 10%. We don't think we did, but that's why we did it. But we have this abiding idea that we're better than this. You know, I can go back to the time of the Origin of Species, which country was number one? The Origin of Species and the Successful Never Failed Races was the subtitle. We have a school system, a university system set up to run an empire. It's a brilliant system for taking children, mainly boys, away from their families, putting those who are going to war into bedrooms with other boys, making them brutal. Taking children away from the town they grew up in and sending them to live in another one to go to university. But the rest of you in Scotland doesn't do that. But it's a brilliant, brilliant system if you're going to hold the Khyber Pass with 12 men, or you're going to play the great game and take Afghanistan. The problem is when you've no longer got an empire, but you still have a system. You know, up the road, you've got Will's Tower, you've got the wonderful, what is it, the four emblems of this university, all slavers, right? And you know, you're playing a game of trying to pretend that you're Oxford, even though Will's Tower is actually a breeze box and a stone clad. I worked here at the university, I'm not being mean, but it's the, well, and a university that takes even posher 18-year-olds than my university does, you know, which has taken some doing. I was admissions officer in geography here. We had 2,000 applications for 100 places. We took more of Harrow, Eton, Roedean and Cheltenham ladies than any other university department in the geography department of Bristol, proportionately, I worked it out at the time.
You were the admissions officer?
I was the admissions. We only had one. So unlike in Oxford where every, you know, you have thousands of admissions officers interviewing, in a normal university, the one new youngest member of staff becomes the admissions officer who has to do the admissions.
I think we only interviewed to reject. To do that. But that's why last one I give you a go about Sheffield, because I was at Sheffield for 10 years before we went to Oxford.
I met all the admissions officers for all the social science departments. They were all the new young academics, but they were also all from mainland Europe. And they had no idea what an A-level was. But they're the ones who have to process the UCAS forms.
But this is a weird, bizarre system. In a normal country, you stay at home in your mum and dad's house, and you go up the road, you know, in Cole or in Athens. You go up the road, you go to university, and you're taught by your friend's parents, who teach you really carefully because they don't really want their children hearing that you're a really bad university teacher. So the quality's really high.
Right? So, oh no, but we have the best universities in the world. You know, and we have gold standard education.
But you test our young people at age 24. And can you guess where we come in the rankings? Ability at doing maths and things like graduates, problem solving. It's a bit different. So why did we muck it up so much? Because we were set up to rule most of the planet. We weren't set up to deal with ourselves. We were set up to be nasty to people, very nasty. Once those terrorists in the 13 colonies had done their terrorism, which in the United States they call revolution or something, and they wonder why we don't celebrate July the 4th, is it? What's that date? Right? We became really brutal. We stopped anybody else getting away from our wonderful, brilliant white man's burden of giving them such great railways and everything else we did. And we were good at that, and we engineered a system that would do that. Look in Hansard and look at the debates amongst the MPs in the 1880s, 1890s about what they're talking about, the need to impose opium on China because free trade really matters. Yeah. And that's the problem. Things got better as they did across Europe, but unlike the rest of Europe, we have a system in place designed to be nasty that we turned inward on ourselves. And we ate ourselves. We destroyed the shipyards at the Clyde in Belfast at the time. We were willing to let Liverpool go. We didn't see mass unemployment as that terrible a problem for most of the 1980s. We were going to go home and fight some wars all over the place. So, you know, we had to get to number one again because that really mattered. George Osborne, 2015. If you follow my economic plan, then by the year 2030, we will be the richest country, large country in the world by per capita income. He sent Matt Hancock out that night around the TV studios to explain his economic plan. When Johnson resigned, he echoed the promise. The sunlit uplands are still there. If you just follow the plan and believe it, we will be. And it was a slightly different promise about how we're going to be ambitious again. Keir Starmer last summer. If we do what Labour want, and if you follow Rachel Reeves' wonderful economic plan, we will have the highest growth rate of the G7 and we will be back. Same old bloody empire story. Rachel went to St John's, Keir did his masters at Teddy's, Johnson went to, is it, no, not Bailey, oh God knows. Truss went to Merton, Sunak went to Lincoln, Tony Blair went to St John's, Gordon at least went to the strike. It's all lots apart from Clegg. It's the ridiculousness of it. And occasionally they do a master's like Hancock, which was in Cambridge in economics, and he calls himself an economist because he did one or two year degrees in another place. The idea of this superiority, but it was a necessary form of education if you are going to send them out. Small numbers of them, and a lot of the world. And they have, and this is my subject of geography, why do you think we created geography in 1899 at the University of Oxford, where young men could come and learn about rivers and flooding and how a city works and where you get resources from? My subject is the subject of how you become a colonial officer. Right? And we were good at it. My subject was in the doldrums by the 1970s because we didn't have any colonies to send them to anymore. America got rid of its geography departments. The rest of the world doesn't have my subject. It only exists in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Singapore. You begin to see the pattern, right? It's very easy to be the number one geography department in the world, which my department is. I'll stop it, but yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It is. If you want to, how did it happen to us? How were we the first country to leave the EU and probably the last? You know, it should have been a small country. God's honor, it should have been a large one. What was different about us to end up with us being so different? I'll end on this one. I have a graph that Eurostat produced about regional inequalities across Europe, which has a bar for each country. The bar for the UK is so high that they have to break the scale on the graph to fit it in, and you can't see which country is the second most unequal. We are the texture of Europe. We are extreme. It's not a marginal thing.
Right, I'm going to, one more question for each of you before I do what you think. I'm going to give you that's all. I want some cheer. You said we need some cheer. So on inequality specifically, I'll come back to that in a second. Samira, like, Danny's kind of talking in grim terms about these deep gravitational forces here in the beverage settlement. You can sort everything out, but you always scream against something rotten in the state of grim. Let's think firstly, tell me if you want a big step or a small step, but one thing you think could be changed within the next few years, if things go well, if we get politics right, that could make a difference to the kind of issues you're worrying about in the group?
That's a good question. I think that the thing that would make the biggest difference, and it might be obvious, is just a review of some of the really punitive policies brought in by the Department of Life and Pensions in recent years, because I think that so much comes back to that. I mean, we were talking before we came up here about the way in which the link between what people need and the money that the state provides supposedly is that safety net's just been completely broken. It's through all manner of different things. But actually, you know, you have destitution by design. The actual basic rate of universal credit is below the threshold at which someone is classified destitute, and so that's sort of designed into the system. It's not a problem. It's a design feature. I was also really struck by the fact that when food bank users, sort of, you analyse the numbers there, when you look at debt that food bank users are in, the single biggest creditor is DWP because of the system of sanctions, and if you need advance payments, which people often do because the payments are just set to below the destitution threshold, so maybe you get an advance payment of £800, then you have £67 or whatever it is taken off your paltry amount of money each month for the next year until it's paid back, which kind of just puts you into this cycle. So I think actually just looking at that realistically, and obviously that's politically been difficult, I think in part because of the rhetoric that's become so normalised over not just the last 10 years, but 20, 30 years in particular. But there are some signs, I think there was some polling recently, wasn't there, that the public is sort of softening on welfare issues. But I think also you maybe just need leadership, maybe just not just about public opinion, which is kind of steered by, you have this, again, a vicious cycle of public opinion steered by politicians, who are steered by focus grouping, etc., etc. It's kind of race to the bottom there. And I think we maybe just need leaders who can say, this is unacceptable, that we have so many people literally starving in such a wealthy country, and we just need to look at there are some really simple policy fixes we could do with the way that this supposed social safety net provided. I think that would be the thing. That's where I'd start.
I think I agree. I'll just chip in on behalf of Joseph Rowntree Foundation, who I've got an association with for the next few weeks. And they've got this campaign together with Trussell Trust, who run the food banks, called an Essentials Guarantee. And the idea is to just look at benefit levels, which no one's ever quite done this thing of saying, well, what do you actually need to survive? And let's make sure benefits need to cover that. And I've just done an exercise. We've not done it in a kind of liberals in a room sort of way, but just ask the public what they think is essential. So, you know, paying council tax, paying it. Gas bill, like mobile phone, like with a little bit of credit so you can get a job if there's one available, etc. And you go through a list of things like that. And you get for a single person to about £120 a week is needed after rent to kind of get by and have that platform of stability where you can get yourself out of poverty in a sustainable way. On the public's own priorities, and that compares to benefit rates. I haven't checked them tonight, but I think that it's sort of about £85 for a single adult, over 25, more like £65, £68, something for someone over 25. So there's this great big gap. And I went on very conservative pundits on program TV and Hartley Brewer, and some of you will know. The point is, no one argues back with you about this. And you say, well, look, you've got, this is the benefits that people get at the moment. And this is that need this much for their water bill, this much to buy a pair of socks every couple of months. These lists are absolute essentials. And what you find is that even a really conservative commentator can't really attack you on that level of what is basic, because you say it's so basic. And there's a long way to go, and I think that argument does carry some force. Now, Danny, you've had your thinking time. Things are going to get better. Now, according to your analysis, quite controversial. People debate how far things did or didn't get better under the last Labour government. You think when it comes to big picture inequality, they didn't get better. In some ways, they got worse. But you think this time, despite the respectability over radicalism in spades of the current Labour leadership, things might actually get better like they did over the years ago.
I think we are at the turn. I think there are just more and more signs that we're at the turn. I don't think it terribly matters who wins the next election. I think the options have run out. We're having to borrow now. 30-year borrowing by government is at 5%. The world doesn't trust us. Italy is a more trusted economy. Every European economy is more trusted than ours. We can't print money. Apologies to any magical money people in the room. We can't print it because we're not America. And if we print it, the pound drops, and our food will cost too much. We can bring in rationing. I mean, other countries in Europe control the prices of food, but we've run out of money. But also, there are lots of signs of things going well. You could take something like further education colleges. Huge turnover of staff, everything going terribly, terribly badly wrong. Really greedy as senior management because it was privatised, taking high salaries and so on. What can you do about that? Really don't need to, because we nationalised them last year. You just didn't notice. The way we do it, it's like the country houses and donating them to National Trust. Because shame really matters in Britain. What we did with the Firm Education Colleges is the Office of National Statistics said that they were no longer private, but they were public, because they looked at where they got their money from, and you couldn't put them in the public accounts as a private sector. And on the same day that ONS released that piece of statistical information, the Department for Education sent the head of every FE college a letter saying you can no longer raise any debt or do anything, you're now part of our department. Right? So ONS and the department got together, nationalised the FE colleges. Why does it matter? There's an unofficial rule, it must be in somewhere. You can't be part of the public sector and pay yourself more than the Prime Minister. It's an unofficial rule, but the same is enormous. We can't do the housing associations yet, because if we bring all their debt onto the public books, then we really can't borrow money from the rest of the world. Same with the student loan book. We've got to pretend that that's their personal loan, even though they can't pay it back. We well over-mortgage ourselves. Every single pay agreement made last year was progressive, for the first time since the 30s. Communication Workers Union in the private sector, 2019, it was a 3%
pay a ward across that they won. Inflation was about 2%, everybody gets 1% more. 3% sounds fair. If you're a senior electrician working for communication, working for BT, your salary's high, 3% is a lot of money. If you're at the bottom, 3% of very little is very little. The latest pay agreement for the Communication Workers Union is the most complicated tier thing, where those at the bottom get the most money. Senior civil servants have lost 25% of their income in real terms since 2008. Junior civil servants have lost 12%. The gap's narrowed. All the gaps are narrowing. And that hasn't happened since the 30s. They're narrowing because they have to narrow, because people at the bottom need these just to eat, to keep them out, mostly off the food banks. And there is no sign of this in the next 2 or 3 years turning around. The housing market, which has been a constant, you know, the policy of our Treasury for 40 years is to try to get house prices as high as they could be in London, because that's a measure of economic success in Europe. I felt really stupid when a senior Treasury official told me that. I've worked on housing for 20 years and simply haven't realised that that was the actual target. Was high house prices are a sign of economic success. Right? But that's the orthodoxy that we... Why do you think we bought all that money to help to buy? It wasn't to help people to buy. It was to keep the house prices up. Well, that's ended. They are coming down in real terms, and it's a nice, slow, steady, long crash, which you want to carry on for 30 years to get to German levels. It's not happening with rents, which have had their biggest increase ever last month, because the landlords can't possibly live, and some of them may not. We have a third of children in London private renting, moving house 3 times every 3 years, losing their friends and having to move school every 3 years. There are loads of messes, but lots of things are turning. Things that we haven't seen happening since the 30s are happening now.
Sure. Yeah. That's a really good point to finish on. I've just seen the clock. We've not got so long. We must have questions.
Yeah.
Let's take a set of three now, and then if we've got time, we'll take a second set of three. Yes, please. Here, we've got one right here. And the second one.
My question is for Samira. And I was wondering if you could speak to some of the intersectional issues around hunger and poverty that you see in your reporting and research, like how migration, race, disability, and gender intersect with poverty and class to cause these social problems.
Great. I'll come to that in a second. We'll just gather three up.
First, a comment. I really liked your analogy of, let's say, social model based on empire, that losing the empire colonizes its regions fundamentally. The question was more about how does a country which doesn't identify itself as an empire anymore reform its electoral system? Because many of the things that you're talking about have to go through democracy, but currently we have an electoral system which rewards a minority regularly over and over again with first past the post and a very hyper-local, sometimes even NIMBYist approach to consensus, which is non-national. So I was just wondering, shouldn't the two main parties be forced to allow us a more proportional system, a little bit like the Scottish system, which okay. Shorter lists?
Got the point, that's great. And there was another one, I think, here.
Danny, you mentioned student loans and the fact that the debt isn't on the national book, and it's perceived as the students, when you all get paid back when they all become high-paying graduates. My children have been elected not to take those kind of careers, and they're not going to pay their loan back, so they're in massive debt. Do you see that as an impending mantra, or just a great colossal hole that we're clearing towards that will hit us? Because both my kids are in Manchester, and the city has developed massively on the amount of money that has been given to landlords primarily, but then they've also spent in bars and other places, and it's created this false boom. And I guess Bristol must be the same as well. I don't know Bristol. I'm visiting, I've come for a really cheerful night out.
Okay. Samira, you go first on intersectionality, and then you chip in on students or PR as you see fit.
Okay, great, thank you. Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think. that all of those things that you mentioned, disability, migration status and so on, are huge driving factors for people in mobility. It's something definitely reporting for this piece on London that I saw a lot. So the food bank in London that I spent time at, staff all had a translate app just so that they would be able to kind of interact with people in real time. There were people coming in speaking so many different languages just in the couple of afternoons that I spent there. And that would often be because they have no recourse to public funds. There were lots of, there were several cases of women who had left an abusive partner or a partner had left them. They had no recourse to public funds or an uncertain migration status that was dependent on their partner and were kind of left looking after kids and relying on food banks. And disability, I think, which is both of these things, migration and disability, are also covered in different chapters in this book, but all these things just intersect so much. Like a lot of people who I spoke to, including the one whose story I read, had had some kind of health problem or physical disability or illness that was the thing that kind of tipped them over into not being able to cope and then not being able to come back out of that hole. And there were numerous people whose stories I wasn't able to include in the chapter who that was their story as well. You know, it's sort of, you have one injury, you can't work, and everything just falls to pieces because everything, I think for so many people, is just so kind of close to the edge at all times. You're kind of, there is no margin of error, that margin of error doesn't exist. And at that point, it's just kind of one of these things that has to go wrong to really tip people over into this abyss that it's really difficult to come back from.
Thanks. I should just say, there's either in the book or even if you don't know, these things are available online for free, more or less. The full chapters by Daniel Trilling and by Francis Rye, respectively, about the element of disability that feeds into this, and about the migrant group and how people get trapped in the immigration system, including interviewees of living in tents and all the rest.
And not being allowed to work.
And not being allowed to work. I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it?
Not allowed to work and not given any.
Sometimes working, but always fearful of being caught.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, so it's like that.
Voting
system and students.
Voting system and students. There are two other countries in Europe, on the edge of Europe, that are as unequal as we are. The first is Russia, which was the centre of an empire, which is USSR. Moscow is an oversized city. And the other is Turkey and Istanbul. And this is slightly worrying because the Ottoman Empire was some time ago, but you see. There's problematic voting. The only two countries in Europe that have spent less than us on public services are Greece shortly after the generals were in charge, and Spain shortly after Franco. So there's a direct connection with democracy. We are not a particularly democratic country. The voting system is bizarre, but so is the House of Lords. It's odd. And many of Europe got rid of it, of this undemocratic way a century ago. There are five countries in Europe which are more equal than the five Nordic countries, and there are five which are almost as equal. There are 15, including France and Germany, which are essentially Finland, all between us and Russia. How are we going to get democracy? Well, for a start, we've got to realise we haven't got it. You know, that takes some explaining to people. If Liberals have a backbone, they would refuse to join any coalition or to supply whatever confidence. Without an agreement that within 100 days we will have a form of PR booked in, no referendum, just straight in. You know, if you don't like it, you can vote for some weird party that will take away your rights in future. You don't need a referendum to bring in PR. I do worry about the backbone of the Liberals, though. I think they quite like this current system, because it means they've got a chance. If you look at who became the ministers in 2010, it was all the millionaire Liberal MPs, men. Apart from the gauge server, Teva had the worst job. And then she collapsed in tears because she was made to sanction everybody. It was just evil. But it always happens, right? The arc does move forward, things progress.
We will have a form of PR at some time, it doesn't matter which one. Our Labour Party will split into two parties, maybe three. Our Tory Party into two or three. We could have two different Green parties and so on. And it'll be very different, and we'll have coalitions in power. And even the current coalition in Finland is far preferable to anything that we have. Singapore, the United States, it's a tiny number of countries that have these undemocratic systems. The Senate in the US, I mean, the most bizarre feudal form of... And the correlation between not having democracy and living with really high levels of inequality and say that they're fine and the problem is just poverty. I'll go back to this because I really am going to change Rantry's mind on this. You know, I don't want to die with the Rantry Foundation still saying we've just got to be a bit nicer to the poor. What was the second question?
About students and the
debt. Oh, sorry, the student and the debt. We've got ourselves to the top of the European league table for going to university. 65% of our youngsters go by the age of 30. Well, because these are all private. Of course, I work for a private institution called the University of Oxford. And the marketing's brilliant. Of course it is, you know, £9,250 a year, and that's just the home fees. Manchester, £38,000 for an overseas degree. And it was kind of based on George Osborne's economic plan. If we had become the richest country in the world by the year 2030 and had the highest GDP per capita, then our salaries would be so high that they could pay the debt off. It doesn't look so good for the car. Who's going to lose out? If any of you have got a mortgage, right, the only people who buy houses nowadays are university graduates, and they're paying back their loans. So when you think you're going to sell your house to them, the money's gone. Already, that's in their loan. So it's housing market keeps on coming down. Should
we get two more? Just maybe.
Yeah.
Do you finish?
I finish.
Two more. I think that's going to be all we can fit in. So you've got one at the front, please, and then let's pass the mic back to Dan.
You mentioned something about the weakness of the British left. I must say, I have to agree with you on that one. I mean, how do you, as an entity, how do you get the people to become a bit stronger and to work together? Because they just seem to struggle all the time.
Yeah. Right, and just pass it back to
you. Yeah, you've written before on the sort of north-south economic divide in the country. People talk about there was a northern powerhouse and now levelling up. What would you say are the drivers of that north-south divide, if it still exists, and how could they be addressed?
So, Samira, if you want a last word, I was going to just say, on the north-south question, your report, you did north and south. Any reflections on that? Is it the same?
I think in terms of what I was reporting on this book, then yeah, it was the same. I'm sure Danny can speak more to the root causes of that. I did actually have a thought on the left point, is that I think having been a working journalist now for the last 15 years, I do think that our media culture has a big role to play in that, and just the kind of heavy right-wing bias in a lot of newspapers, I do think sort of makes it difficult. What I was talking about earlier in terms of the sort of loop between political rhetoric and focus groups dictating policy, which dictates political rhetoric, which dictates focus groups, etc., etc. I think that is quite difficult to break out of in terms of the sort of discourse of this country. I don't know what the solution is, but I think that's a big problem.
Back to the media. Okay, Danny, a quick word on either of those, and then we must stop.
Now, I think people like me have spent too much of our lives talking about Margaret Thatcher and that lot as if they were super able. And because I'm left wing, we were happy to swallow our heroes line. But if you look at the Labour Party in the 20s and 30s, it was an absolute disarray, like even more than it is today. It's followed the 1923 election and then onwards and defections and what happened.
we tell ourselves this lie about the 45 government. You know, Beveridge was a Liberal, Tory health minister was certainly involved, and half the Conservatives were for what was going on. When the Conservatives came back in 51, they actually built more council houses than Labour. But we like to tell ourselves that. Wilson was a nice man, he kept us out of the Vietnam War, but not as radical. The equivalent in Germany is Merkel, you know, who spends more than Corbyn ever promised to spend, and certainly much nicer to refugees. The German public spending under Merkel's higher, they believe in having people on boards is higher. I'm not having a go at Jeremy Corbyn, I guess like Jeremy Corbyn. It's just he's an incredibly right-wing social democrat in mainland European terms. Right? And that's not his fault, you know, it's not as if he didn't try and be a bit different. And you take a look at Merkel on 1.5 million Syrians, of which there's been no disbenefit to Germany. You don't get talk of small boats in Germany. Small boats. I mean, honestly, right? We've got to get ourselves out of that. And we haven't examined ourselves about our left. And I think we didn't have the solidarity of being a resistance fighters in the Second World War, which a lot of the European left did. You literally were fighting the Nazis on your own land under occupation. Or, the by far the best thing that can happen to a country, you lose a war and your elite are chucked out, as the case of Germany and Japan. That's the fastest way to progress. Right? It's been a long time since that's happened.
The
North-South divide. It's back again. It was growing the most in the 30s. I'm very nerdy. I charted how the population centre of the country moved, and it moved fastest southward in the 30s, and this period is now. People really did get on their bike. There were 6 years in the 1970s when it moved north. Right, that's out of the last century. It's an ancient divide. It's to do with snobbery and class and where you're willing to be. I say class because I lived for 10 years in Newcastle. It's not an affectation. I say Newcastle because I lived for 10 years in Newcastle, and you have to spend 10 years. You can take it right back to the Harrier of the North, and you know that's documented by 1086. But it is staggering because there are divides in all European countries. They are trivial compared to what we managed to maintain and keep. And your fundamental problem is this Roman port called London, which if you really want to get rid of the North-South divide, you move Parliament to the east of Birmingham over the Y intersection of HS2. You complete those last two legs of HS2 because it's only 30 minutes to get to Parliament. You sell the Houses of Parliament to the Chinese, the seven-star hotel, also spent $5 billion renovating it. And you're serious about it. If you want a fast track out of not having to play the same game as Russia and Moscow, you know, you've got to do something about concentrating everything in London so that you come at 18 to Oxford and at 21 you go and get that job at Carlton TV in London and then you do the dinner tables in Islington and, you know, we did that show.
I think that's a good point about the concentration in London, absolutely, and it's a problem for the structure of our country. But I do think that it's quite easy to sort of generalise, and in fact the level of privation and deprivation in London are remarkable. I think that those gulfs are huge.
Yeah, it's the greatest concentration of poverty in Europe, in the middle of London. Which we absolutely tolerate as being okay, but could we be slightly nicer to the poor? Just a little bit nicer? Which really means, can we please keep what we've got almost exactly as it is? Which is why you need for the money to run out, so that you can't carry on doing that anymore, and the money has run out. Inflation is still higher than increases in wages. We're still not back to 2008 wage levels. We are on course to beat the longest wage decline in the history of Britain, which began in 1798 under the Napoleonic Wars and didn't finish by 1822. But, you know, we are setting records we've never set before for this thing, which an optimistic thing is, you can't carry on doing it.
There we go. That is a note on which we need to stop. If anyone would be interested in Danny's book or in Samira's book on Karachi. I think they're all there if anyone's interested. If people want to read bits and pieces, I can point them to some stuff online if people can't afford to buy the book or don't want to commit to buy the book, that's fine. But thank you all very much for coming out this evening, and thanks to Danny and to Samira for being so engaging in the debate.